Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday. As I mentioned before the news, we began an experiment this summer that we've decided to make permanent, to spend part of our Friday programs following up, to dig deeper on some things that came up briefly during the week. And we will do that right now with three things. Four things, actually. Later in the hour, we'll get your reactions to a listener comment on our website that says there's a difference between being gay and being homosexual, and that Larry Craig is the latter. We'll hear from a group called Yes, the Bronx, who wants to say no to some comments about the borough that they heard on the show. And we'll see how you iPhone owners feel about the early adopter tax you paid by buying it before the price went down. But first, I mentioned the other day an article in the Times warning you new college freshmen in town about some of the hazards of living in New York City, specifically the one that said, "Don't play chess for money with the hustlers in Washington Square Park. As they are hustlers, they will take your money," it said. It continued, "Also, you could be hit with a summons for unlawful gambling and sent to the criminal courts where a judge would determine what you owe," unquote. Well, in response to that in the Times, we got one of our most interesting phone calls of the week. So we will replay it right now and then speak to a chess grandmaster from here in New York who might know this guy.
Hey, what's up?
You're a chess hustler?
Yeah, I hustle chess. I've been doing it for, I'm retired now. I'm a retired photojournalist. And I come out in the park and we play chess. You can refer to me as a hustler if you will, but it's not a hustle.
You're just good at chess and you play for money against people who come up to challenge you?
Yes, we do. And what happens is, especially this time of year, we get quite a few students that'll come through and say, "Where else would you care to play a game, sir?" "Oh, yeah." And they'll sit down. They can't play at all.
So it's not like three-card Monty where you're swapping out the rooks for the knights or something like that.
We instruct these students, and these are very intelligent young guys and sometimes girls. And oftentimes, by the time they become juniors, they beat us.
Is that in Washington Square Park in your case?
This has been going on for years.
Yeah.
And
it's
not a hustle. I don't know why they refer to it as that. The kids want to learn to play chess. They have an 8 o'clock class, and next one's at 9:40, and we'll go back to the dorm. So every day they'll come out there and play us.
It's funny that this comes up, because I just this summer read the book by the former chess grandmaster from New York, Josh Waitzkin.
Right, I played.
Do you
Josh
know him?
7 years old, yeah.
That's it, and that's the story that he tells in the book. That when he was 6, 7 years old, he was going to Washington Square Park and playing guys like you, and he portrayed you only positively as good-hearted, hard players, but really taking care of him and teaching him a kind of street smart version
that's
of chess as opposed to academic version.
Well, that's what made Bobby Fischer so prolific. Bobby Fischer went against the grains that the standards that Russia had set in chess. He put a different dynamic on it, a very daring all-out attack. And aside from what, the old standard rules of Capablanca and Morphy and all the old chess greats. And he became the youngest world champion ever.
That's right. Richard,
I got to go.
But the Times also says, it's illegal to gamble in the park.
Well, they took him to court on that, too, and they lost because the judge defined there is no element of luck in the game of chess, thereby it cannot be called gambling.
There you go. Thanks for your call. I really appreciate it. So that call from Tuesday's show from Richard in Manhattan. And joining me now is the chess champion I referred to in that call, Josh Waitzkin, a New Yorker who grew up in the Village, was an 8-time national chess champion, and went on to be a Tai Chi champion as well. You may remember that he was the subject of the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, and he is the author of a new book called The Art of Learning, A Journey in the Pursuit of Excellence, published by the Free Press. Josh, it's great to have you on WNYC. Thanks for coming on and doing this.
It's great to be here, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So do you know that guy? Can you recognize him just from that call-in?
I do recognize his voice and his vibe, the way he speaks. Great guy.
Well, I really enjoyed reading your book this summer.
Thank you.
And it starts with you as a little kid calling Washington Square Park your second home for your time spent with these street chess players there who first taught you the game. Can you tell our listeners about how you got involved with them?
Sure. You know, those guys were my first teachers, and it's easy to vilify them. You know, that Times article that you mentioned, it's a little bit sad. Those guys, you know, I was 6 years old initially walking with my mom through the park heading for the monkey bars. I was just playing on the mounds, and something caught my eye, and I watched these two street hustlers playing, and they had this incredible passion about chess. And they're actually at quite a high level, those guys. And then I watched, a couple days later, came back with my mom, and I broke away from my mom, ran up to a man who was playing there, and I asked him if he could play, and I didn't know how to play. And my first game of chess was sitting across from this old man named David Hecklinger trying to figure it out, and he thought I was trying to hustle him, actually.
You were trying to hustle him at 6 years old?
Well, that's the funny thing. I had some feel for the game innately, I guess. But he buckled down, a big crowd gathered around, and he ended up beating me, and he asked my name, wrote it on a piece of paper. And he said, Josh Waite's going to be reading about you in the paper someday. And that was my first game of chess.
And the way you tell it in the book, you love these guys, and you found them anything but threatening.
You know, they cleaned up their act when I came to play. Of course, it's not like this is like playing chess in some austere club. But what it is it's an incredibly dramatic atmosphere. It's a place where the street side of the game, the real fighting combat aspect of the game, is explored, and they're incredibly great players. Not necessarily classically trained, like, for example, Russian rivals who I had to deal with for so many years mm-hmm. later. But I've long said that if you can't get hustled in Washington Square Park, then you can't get hustled anywhere.
What do you think of the term street hustler? Because Richard rejected it.
I don't like I think what he said is true. You know, most people who go to the park go there, and they're basically paying to play a couple games of chess. And I don't think they're hustling. I mean, for the most part, they're just playing chess. Now, of course, there are sometimes incredibly intense and exciting clashes where you have two of the top guys in the park facing off against one another, and then it gets to be this great trash talking back and forth. But that's exciting, just like an NBA game. I don't like the idea of calling them so much hustlers as chess players.
But you agree that they're not hustlers in the sense of a three-card Monty comparison?
Oh, of course. Of course. They're playing chess over the board, and they're great players, and they're great guys, and they've taught me so much, you know, a very easy way to navigate.
Wait, I mean, do they cheat or don't they cheat?
No, they don't cheat.
Don't cheat.
I've never seen them cheat in all my years there. But a very easy way for people to navigate this is you just go there and I never took a dollar off of anyone in Washington Square Park, even when I was beating them. You go there, you say, you pay a couple dollars to play some chess and to learn some things about chess. It's a wonderful way to do it.
You mentioned that street smart element, and I know there's a difference in style between street smart and training smart in lots of physical sports like basketball and baseball. But is it true in chess, too? Can you give an example to our listeners who might know a little bit of chess?
Well, of course. I mean, people like Mikhail Tal, who is one of the great world champions, a Latvian player, he was probably the purest example of an incredibly aggressive, tactical player who would make pure chaos on the board, and he could navigate the chaos better than his opponents, even while sometimes over the board, if you had a computer breaking it down in today's chess game, you'd be able to see that it wasn't fundamentally sound. The truth of the matter is that at a high level, chess has two components. There's the classical side of the game, and then there's the fighting side of the game. They have to be integrated. And in my early chess education, I had both. I had playing in Washington Square Park, and then I had my classical teacher who taught me from the foundation up. And those dual components were fantastic for my learning process.
Josh Waitzkin, former chess champion, author of The Art of Learning, A Journey in the Pursuit of Excellence. And I should mention, since we have a few minutes, that your book is not really about chess so much as about the title, The Art of Learning and the Pursuit of Excellence. Do you think the lessons that you learned in pursuit of chess mastery and Tai Chi mastery are generally applicable no matter what your field?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for one thing, chess and the martial arts, you could say, they couldn't be more different. And what was interesting to me in my learning process when I switched over into the martial arts in my early 20s was how all the lessons, all the principles that I learned from chess crossed straight over. And then I became fascinated with the learning process, and I began to explore what were these principles, what was happening in my learning process, and I ultimately went on to win two world championship titles in the martial arts. And so what I do in the book is I basically am exploring these principles of learning and performance psychology, which don't apply to one thing or two things, but to everything. I think that, you know, fundamentally the most interesting thing about the learning process to me is finding thematic connections, looking for the hidden interconnectedness of diverse pursuits. And to be honest with you, I think that all started for me in the park. Because those guys, they're not just playing chess, they're entering your mind, and they're having this incredibly intense psychological battle with you. And in my experience in world championship martial arts competition, technically, conditioning, these guys are all great, and what makes the difference is the psychological game, and then it comes down to, you know, whether you can stand up to the pressures being put on your mind, maintain the tension, be at peace with it.
And this is at a very high level, a level that most people never achieve at anything. I mean, you ask questions in this book like, let's say we've become very good at something. How do we become exceptional?
Right.
And I wonder if you want to address that question briefly. Maybe introduce one of your concepts like finding your trigger or making smaller circles, as you call it.
Well, what I mean by building your trigger, what I'm referring to is the idea of taking, in performance psychology, people often build up routines to trigger an ideal performance state. And I had done this in my chess career. And then the first time I went to a world championship in the martial arts, I had this 30-minute routine that I'd go through. But then I had this hilarious thing where I was called on to compete at 8 a.m. in the world championship first round in Taiwan. And I got there 8 a.m. ready to go, and then 8 a.m. passed, 9 a.m. passed, 10 a.m. I was ready for action. I was ready to go. I was rearing. I was doing my routine. 11, 12 o'clock, they had finally announced a lunch break. And by 12:30, they had served this greasy platter of pork fried rice and fried duck, and it was the only food to eat anywhere. So I ate it, and by the time I had just eaten, they announced my round. I had to run downstairs. My opponent was on the mats in a sweat, warmed up. He knew the schedule. And I got blown out of the water. I traveled all the way to Taiwan, and I learned that what you have to do is have a performance state which can be triggered instantly. So I describe how to build up a routine and ultimately how to condense the routine to making smaller circles, to make the circles smaller and smaller and smaller until ultimately you can do the same thing with a blink of an eye. And I describe my system that I developed.
So it's like doing a meditation by just a small act that represents the meditation.
Exactly. I think that, you know, I
really... That's hard. Can you really do that?
You can do that. You can do it, and it manifests in a lot of ways. I mean, in terms of technical integration, the idea of making smaller circles can also relate to a technique. In chess, it can relate to a chess principle, or in the martial arts, it can relate to, for example, a punch or a throw. You start with a big classical movement, then you make it more and more condensed and more potent until ultimately you're doing an incredibly dramatic thing with huge effect, but you're actually moving very little. And in the chess example, you're playing. For example, you're controlling the center without controlling the center at all. And that's why great masters can look mystical to an untrained eye, because they've made things so refined, so condensed, so potent, that you can't see it unless you've gone through that process yourself.
But you actually kind of dissed the mystical thing. I mean, you got into Tai Chi as a spiritual escape from the competition of chess.
Right.
But then you wound up getting into the competitive side of that, Tai Chi as martial art,
right,
and becoming a national champion at that, too. So you must be a very competitive guy in the first place. But you seem to find your own spiritual core through Tai Chi, but you also dismiss anything mystical about getting good at it.
It's well put, yeah. You know, I initially got into the competitive side of Tai Chi in order to experience something that was outside of my conceptual scheme. And I was kind of putting a chess player's methodical mind to the martial arts. And it was a really fascinating experience, because if something happened, I'd break it down until I could understand it. So many martial arts masters call themselves grandmasters and claim to have these abilities which no one else can replicate. But what I've taken on as kind of a way of life is observing what the greatest artists can do and then trying to understand where it springs from and how you can technically refine it and ultimately make it something that you can systematically build yourself to. And I think anybody can. And I really believe in breaking down these quote-unquote mystical ideas into something you can incrementally refine.
Training rather than mysticism, although the spiritual masters say you really reach enlightenment through rigorous training as well. One thing before you go.
Sure.
For people who know you from the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, it seems from this book like you gave up chess because fame got in your way after you were featured in that movie. Did fame destroy your love for the game?
Well, I wouldn't say that it was just that fame did it. I think that there were two large components. One was that the movie pushed me into a more externalized relationship to chess. I'd always played for this intense love for the game and love for the learning process that came out of chess, and suddenly I did find myself playing to live up to other people's expectations instead of for my own love for the game and for the journey. On the other hand, there was another component, which was that I had a coach or a series of coaches who were pushing me to play the opposite side of chess that was true to me. I had always been this creative, attacking, intuitive chess player. I like to create chaos on the board, very much in the spirit of Washington Square Park, and then weave my way through the chaos more efficiently and more intuitively than my opponents. My greatest strength was the ability to find hidden harmonies, and my coaches urged me to play this other side of chess, the anti-Josh chess, to play this conservative style of basically positionally squeezing the opponent, and it went against my grain. So what happened is that I lost my natural voice as a competitor at the same time and as an artist at the same time that I had to navigate these external realities relative to the fame of the movie. And these two things, this 1-2 punch, threw me off. And I've come to understand this, the central idea of my book, is that everybody has their own unique path they have to follow, and we all have our natural strengths and differences. And so I don't believe that we should jam everybody into anybody into a cookie cutter mold that might have worked for somebody else, and that's what happened to me.
By the way, do you did you know about that New York Times article that dissed the street chess players before we brought it to your attention and
no,
had a reaction?
No, honestly, I didn't. I just got back from a month-long fishing trip. I've been out of the country.
I didn't
know about it. I after my book tour, I took off and left everything.
That's a way for an active guy to find spiritual peace, right? Go fishing.
I think it's a very important part of my life, yeah.
Josh Waitzkin, author of The Art of Learning, A Journey in the Pursuit of Excellence, published by the Free Press. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks so much, Brent.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, more Follow-Up Friday. We'll get your reactions to a listener comment on our website that says there's a difference between being gay and being homosexual as it pertains to Larry Craig. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget you can sign up for our podcast. It's free. We podcast one segment of the show every day. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And it's not just Friday, it's Follow-Up Friday when we dig a little deeper into some things that came up briefly during the weekend. We'll open the phones now on the question, is there a difference between being gay and being homosexual as it pertains to Larry Craig? Now, I ask because a gay listener raised this question in connection with the Craig scandal. You know about Senator Craig from Idaho, right? And his guilty plea in relation to an alleged sexual pickup attempt of another man in the Minneapolis airport bathroom. Well, in our conversations about Craig, here as in most places, we talked about the notion that Craig might be gay. And that prompted this comment from a listener who submitted it on our corrections page. And by the way, I invited you to call in. I should give the phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So here's what this listener wrote. I beg you, please, please, please stop referring to Larry Craig as gay, as though this was the problem. He is sexually confused. The LGBT community, and gay men specifically, have worked long and hard to establish the term gay as opposed to the medically derived homosexual. This was to distinguish it as a sexual orientation as opposed to a medical diagnosis. Gay specifically has connotations of pride, self-worth, self-respect, and integration of one's sexuality with one's life. It is a difficult thing to achieve, coming out to oneself as well as to one's family and loved ones. It is harrowing. And those of us who identify as gay deserve to make a distinction between us and closeted, dishonest, confused homosexuals who have real psychological issues. And he goes on, it is extremely disheartening to be lumped into the same category as this man, and it confuses the issue. Homosexual hypocrisy is the issue here. Self-loathing is the issue. I hope you can finally come to understand and share with your listeners that there is a world of difference. And as for the behavior in the bathroom, it is classic closet behavior. Bathrooms aren't being plagued with prowling, predatory gay men, but they are probably frequently filled with closeted men looking to connect with other closeted men. It's what almost every closeted homosexual man I ever knew did before he discovered he was not the only one, not sick, and could live a healthy, happy, and fulfilling life as a gay man. So what do you think of that, listeners? Let's follow up, especially if you are gay yourself. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As he said, he originally submitted that as I said, he originally submitted that as a correction, and now we've put it on our webpage so you can see it easily at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to read the whole thing. Those were some major excerpts. But is there a difference between being gay and homosexual? The medicalized term, as the writer puts it, should we use the word gay to connote a more or less open attraction to people of the same sex and homosexual to connote someone who is closeted and all twisted up about it, someone whose sexuality comes out in self-loathing ways, as the writer puts it, like secret airport bathroom hookups with other closeted strangers? What do you think about this dichotomy? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
I am gay.
I am in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I actually was on the call on the phone with the screener while you were reading most of the message, so I missed a lot of what the person posted. But
okay.
It was just as soon as you mentioned the segment, I called in because I was saying exactly the same thing or more or less the same thing just a day or so ago
uh-huh.
to my partner. You know, I don't really think this guy is gay. I think he just likes to have sex with dudes. And what I meant by that is that he apparently this has been an ongoing issue for him for 20 years or more. And he continues to insist that he's not gay, but he continues to have sex with men, as opposed to, say, Jim McGreevy, who took a very long time to come around, but ultimately realized what was going on and made changes in his life and came out officially and
right.
publicly.
And even if it was meant as somewhat of a distraction from his corruption problems, he said, I am a gay American.
Yes. So I don't really know exactly what this guy Craig is, but it's really strange to think of him as gay in the classic sense.
Michael, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it a lot. Joey in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joey.
Hi. Yeah, your question prompted me to remember the play Angels in America
mm-hmm.
when Roy Cohen, the character, confronts his doctor who tells him he has AIDS. And Roy Cohen says, homosexuals have AIDS. I am not a homosexual. I am a man who has sex with men.
Huh.
Homosexuals have no clout. They can't even get a blankety-blank equal rights bill through City Hall. So in his mind, he was sort of equating, he was saying, you know, I am not basically gay or homosexual. I am just a man who has sex with men.
Right. And so that was pre-gay. I mean, that was, you know, Roy Cohn was
right.
before the word gay was really in common usage.
Exactly.
For this. And so he was saying, the distinction that he was making was between homosexual, which really means gay in this case,
right.
and a man who has sex with other men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And it's ironic, too, because he even took his gay lover to meet the Reagans, you know, for example, but did not consider himself gay.
Joey, thanks a lot. Marcia, or is it Marcia, in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, no, it's Marcia.
Hi.
Yeah, Brian, I loved that you read that comment from your listener because when I first heard the stories about Larry Craig being gay, it just bothered me and I couldn't quite figure out why, but your listener just definitely articulated it. And I'm gay and Larry Craig is definitely a homosexual.
Thank you very much. Larry in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, hi. I think I want to clear up the differences between the terms homosexual, gay, men who have sex with men, and bisexual. I'm a psychologist.
Uh-huh.
First of all, homosexual is not a medical term anymore, certainly. It used to be way back when. Now homosexuality is not a mental illness. There is such a thing as ego-dystonic homosexuality, which basically means that you're upset about being gay. And that's something that mental health practitioners can work with, although the results are kind of equivocal.
To make you accept yourself more or to change your sexuality?
Well, I think changing your sexuality, there's a problem with that. Certainly it's easier to help you come to terms with who you really are.
Yeah.
Gay is certainly a newer term, and it's interesting, the caller who talked about Roy Cohn, I think that was Tony Kushner putting words in Roy Cohn's mouth.
Could be.
And the other point that I wanted to make is that Freud certainly talked about sexuality as being inherently bisexual. And that it's only through the course of
socialization uh-huh.
that we make a choice of being predominantly one sex or the other.
You think that's true?
I actually do, and there's some research which suggests that that may be true across species, not about the cultural part, but that there are certainly species have certain percentages of members in which exhibit homosexual behavior.
But very small percentages, right? I mean, there are very few species
right,
that
but it happens.
Have it. Oh, you're saying just as in the human case, very few people, relatively a small percentage of people, wind up as gay or lesbian. Some parallel to that, a small percentage, but across many species is what we observe?
I don't know how many species, but I do know that it does
yeah.
happen. happen.
All right. All right. Thank you very much. Andrew in Dobbs Ferry. You're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I'd like to address the person, you know, the person who made the original complaint and the attempt to distinguish the words gay from homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that what he's trying to do is convert established language to the uses of his own viewpoint. In other words, he's trying to politicize it. Traditionally, the term gay emerged as a synonym for the term homosexual, perhaps a more friendly, gentle vernacular term, and initially within the homosexual or gay community.
He acknowledges, by the way, that he's doing exactly what you say. I mean, I'll read again from the note. He writes, the LGBT community and gay men specifically have worked long and hard to establish the term gay as opposed to the medically derived homosexual. So he is doing that intentionally.
He is doing that, and thank you for pointing that out. I guess the point of my comment is that trying to appropriate language that way is a form of intellectual hijacking of the language itself.
Well, I don't know. And, you know, I'm not sure I would cast the same aspersions on it. He is obviously trying to frame an idea through the use of language and the recasting of the word homosexual. Whether that makes it hijacking or intellectually dishonest, I'm not sure. I think he's trying to create a distinction in people's minds that maybe they didn't have before, and you got to use some kind of words to do it, and that's the way he chose to do, or that the movement over time has chose to do it.
I don't object to his making the distinction, and I'm not denying the validity of the distinction he's making. My argument is strictly one of linguistics. It's strictly in mm-hmm. one about the legitimacy mm-hmm. of trying to use established language to put faces on things, to create ideas behind imagery, and to divert words that have established mm-hmm. meanings in order to do that. I think it confuses the dialogue that we all go through every day, and by confusing it, muddies the waters and doesn't really serve clear advancement of the discussion.
Andrew, thank you for your call. Thad in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Thad.
Hi there. First, I just want to say I love your show.
Thank you.
Every day.
Thanks.
But I think, ironically enough, Larry Craig himself understood and underscored the difference between the two words in his own intent to resign speech, or whatever we're calling it now.
Really?
When he said, I am not gay, I have never been gay. And the first time I heard that, I thought, wait a minute, no right-wing Republican uses those words. They use the words homosexual. He, in fact, is correct. He never has been gay. He's never been proudly gay or openly gay, and his sexuality doesn't appear to be integrated into his life.
What do you think?
He is a homosexual.
Yeah. What do you think about the previous caller just prior to you, and whether there is any confusion that this conversation sows around the word homosexual? I mean, I completely understand what the writer is saying of this note to us, of what you're saying, but homosexual, I mean, it's a technical term. Homo means, you know, the same, and sexual is, you know, having to do with sex. So there's a technical term there that has to do with sexual orientation in a technical sense, and maybe gay is a more cultural thing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I work in the medical field, and I feel like it's the difference between describing a female Caucasian and a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, we're men and women. We don't
right.
call ourselves
but,
males.
But
and
is there something lost by gays and lesbians using the word homosexual now in a disparaging way?
I don't think I don't think it's being used in a disparaging way. I think it's being used in an accurate way to describe a limited identity that is solely based upon activity and not around identity. You know, gay is an identity, whereas homosexuality is an activity
right.
or a proclivity.
So the total flip side,
depending upon depending on how attractive the undercover cop is.
Of course. Well, I can't beat that, so I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Thad.
Thank you.
And you know what? I think that's it for this conversation. I appreciate all of your feedback on that. I thought that was an interesting thing to follow up on this follow-up Friday program, which will continue in a minute with some people from the Bronx who objected to the way that borough's name was taken in vain on the show. Stay with us.
So you think that hip-hop had its start out in Queensbridge? If you pop that junk up in the Bronx, you might not live, cause you're in
South Bronx, the South, South Bronx, South Bronx, the South, South Bronx.
It's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday, and as we dig a little deeper into the stories we've been following, I want to go back a few weeks ago now, when we had a call in to get your ideas for a slogan for the Bronx. Here were some of those ideas.
Welcome to the Boogie Down Bronx.
The Bronx is up.
Just kicking it in the Bronx.
Da Bronx. D-A Bronx.
Celebrate the Bronx. We're still one family.
Life's better in the Bronx.
Bronx, we love it, and so will you.
The Bronx, the best.
There's no better than the Bronx.
The Bronx, cheer.
And I cheer for all you great callers who came up with that, all of that. But this sparked a response from the two businessmen whose branding strategy you may have seen written about in the papers. They came up with the idea for the sign that states, "Yes, the Bronx," that originally motivated that call-in, because some people don't like the "Yes, the Bronx" sign idea, such as Councilman Oliver Capel, who called the sign cheap and cheesy. So joining me now are Dan Smith and Alec, is it Diaku?
Diaku.
Diaku, to defend their sign. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having us.
So Dan, first talk about your sign, "Yes, the Bronx." What do the words mean? And talk about the physical design of it.
Well, thank you for having us. We wanted to clarify, it's not a sign. You know, it's part of an overall campaign that we have that Dan will get into to rebrand the Bronx, to change the national perceptions and stereotypes about the Bronx. But it's an installation, a sculpture, a piece of art. It's not a sign.
And I called you Dan, you're Alec. Dan, you want to follow up?
The explanation of what we're trying to do, as Alec said, it's not a sign. We need not to denote where somebody is. I think the traffic engineers have done a good job in doing that, telling you where you are. We need to connote all the positive things about the Bronx and the pent-up potential of the Bronx that people don't realize.
The difference between being homosexual and being gay. But maybe not. The idea for the call-in wasn't necessarily to disparage the idea of the Yes, the Bronx campaign, the phrase you came up with, but to build on it. I wasn't here. There was a guest host that day. But what was it that you didn't like about the way we approached that?
Just that this is bigger than a sign, and not just the conception that it's a piece of sculpture. But we, first and foremost, it's a two-part campaign. It's a grassroots campaign, and it can't succeed without the grassroots effort. But it also has to be taken national and international. Otherwise, we never break down the stereotypes and perceptions that currently exist. The Bronx never becomes a destination point, only something you pass through on your way to Greenwich or, you know, the Berkshires.
And it remains Fort Apache in
exactly.
The public mind. Is this similar or different from slogans such as "Queens, the Borough of Dreams," or the signs that Marty Markowitz has erected in Brooklyn, like "Brooklyn, how sweet it is"?
We don't consider it a slogan. We consider "Yes, the Bronx" a platform. It is much, much broader than saying it's a slogan. McDonald's has slogans. There's a lot of people who have slogans that change perhaps once or twice a year. It is a very powerful platform that we think will change people's perception of the Bronx.
You're businessmen. What kind of business are you in?
Myself, I'm in branding.
Uh-huh. And Alec?
I'm a former economist and investment banker, and now I'm restoring old mansions in the Bronx.
But is this public perception going to help the fates of businesses in the Bronx? Is that part of the idea?
I think it helps everybody. I mean, I am an example of what we are trying to, the people we're trying to reach and the perceptions we're trying to change. I came up to the Bronx in 1997. I didn't move there, but to view the Bronx when my son was accepted to Bronx Science. I now have two sons who graduated from Bronx Science. But when I first went up there, you know, I drove around the neighborhood. I stopped the squad cars. I asked them if it was safe, you know, all of these things. Well, going up there once a week when my sons were in high school, I fell in love with the place. I eventually bought a house in 2000, moved my family up there, and now I'm restoring 1920s mansions.
That's
I
great.
Love the
That's
place.
That's fabulous. But, Dan, there is a physical sign that's part of this, right, that would be visible from the highway?
Yes. We want to make at least a three-story sign. Well, I hate to say sign again, an installation that we want all Bronxites to help us with this. I think that when we were criticized about it being called a sign, people didn't get the details, really. You know, we had people calling in about slogans, but basically, like I said, it's a platform, and the physical installation is going to be very, very large. It's going to have the presence of the Statue of Liberty, and it's going to define the spirit of the Bronx.
But I think that's the part that Councilman Capel objected to as cheesy, his word. If you've got this three-story sign, platform, excuse me, that says, yes, the Bronx, that people see as they drive by.
It's cheesy if you build it cheesy. If you build it beautiful, it's beautiful. And we want it to be more than that. We want it to be effective.
When will we see it?
We hope as soon as possible. We still need a lot of input from the Bronx people, because another element of this is we want to build it with all Bronx recyclable material, bottles, plastic, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Which represents the Bronx, basically. The Bronx was down and out, and now we're taking the same area as the Bronx, and we're rebuilding it, just like recycled materials.
Dan Smith, Alec Diakou, I say yes, the Bronx. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It is Follow Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper on things that have come up on the show. And way back, July 6th to be exact, eons ago in the tech world, we had a call-in segment on the brand new, 1 week old at that time, iPhone. Back then, our listeners gave the new phone pretty glowing reviews, despite its hefty price tag.
I am in love with my iPhone. I absolutely love it.
I think it's beautiful. I'm a little bit self-conscious about using it. People take it away from me wherever I go.
It is a thing of beauty.
It is a thing of beauty. However, this week Apple announced that it is slashing the price of that thing of beauty by $200, an act that has some people who paid full price a little bit upset. So we're going to take some phone calls right now about what some are calling an early adopter tax on those who just couldn't wait for the new iPhone. Here with me now to help take your calls is Sri Srivanasan. He's the Dean of Students and Professor of Journalism at the Columbia School of Journalism. He's a tech reporter for Channel 4 and co-founder of the South Asian Journalists Association while he's at it. Sri, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Great to be here.
And we're going to open our phones. Anybody out there who called back on July 6th to rave about your iPhone, how do you feel now? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And by the way, in case you haven't heard, you can at least get $100 of credit at the iStore. Do I have that right, Sri?
That's the idea, that this rebate was announced and put together so quickly that not everyone really knows what the details are, and they're posting the information on the website.
At the Apple Store. So it's not a refund, but it's credit at the Apple Store. And I guess the cynical take here is that the vaunted iPhone might not be selling at the $600 level, so suddenly it's a $400 phone. What do you think?
Well, I thought that the Apple iPhone at that price was too high, and that's why I don't own one, and also that I'm not on the AT&T service plan. But anyone who asked me, I was telling them that it's a great phone. I've played with it, tested it, but hold on and see what the next price point is going to be. I didn't expect it to drop so quickly, but that's already happened.
Maybe to some people, the $200 was worth it just for 2 months of smugness.
Yes, and some Apple people can be very, very smug.
How much would you pay to say, I have one and you don't? Matthew in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. Actually, one of the things that has kind of gotten no mention is the people who bought the $500 iPhone. They get no refund. So if you really look at some of the chatter that was going on, they're getting doubly, you know, shafted, basically. There were a lot of people who said, well, I just want an iPod, so I'll get, you know, the $500 one and get 4 gigabytes for an iPod. Well, for that price, you can get the sixteen gigabyte iPod Touch and not have a contract. Otherwise, you know, if you wanted the iPhone, well, now the people with the 8 gigabyte iPhone, they got twice the storage space for the exact same price. And it's the 4 gigabyte owners, they got nothing, absolutely nothing.
Matthew, thank you. Sri, is he right about the price points versus memory capacity?
Yes, I've been looking at this, and he's right, because they're phasing out the smaller sized iPhone. And by the way, you have some great comments already coming into to your website,
to the comments page,
the comment section. And I wanted to just point out one of them where it says, if you're so giddy about gadgetry and buy into insulting marketing techniques about new technologies, then you deserve to pay extra.
And if you want to build on that and engage in your own act of Schadenfreude or anything else, you can go to wnyc.org. and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Mike in Fairfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
What you got?
I want to say that this is pretty much just a matter of marketing gone horribly, horribly astray. I work in IT. I've had a couple of high-end phones and other smartphone devices in my time. I own an iPod, and when the iPods themselves come down in price, A, you don't see those come, with a $100 credit to the Apple Store, and B, whenever any other high-end technology device, be it a computer, a smartphone, hell, even a BlackBerry or a Trio, mm-hmm. those don't get a price drop. Those don't get an accompanying rebate. You don't get any credits on your phone bill for that. So this is pretty much just marketing hype. This is just a lot of people complaining loud enough.
Mike, thanks for your call. If you want to call in, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. iPhone owners especially encouraged. It's funny, you know, Sri, they all lined up to call in on that first week that they owned one. Now, there aren't a lot of iPhone owners calling to say how they feel today, but you are welcome. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or maybe you're all posting on the web. But he's right. The caller is right, Sri, that, you know, you don't see it when any other piece of technology goes down, that that there's actually a refund or credit issued by the manufacturer. Is there any precedent for this?
There have been some technologies and some companies that have done very, very small rebates if they've reduced the price. But this is also unprecedented in the sense that the price drops so quickly. I'm a big believer that technology gets better, faster, and cheaper all the time. And if you wait, it'll get better and cheaper. But the people who jumped on this and wanted it, for them, I'll tell you, some of the folks that have been writing to me are not complaining. They're happy with the $100. They knew. They went in with their eyes open about the price point.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not that everyone is unhappy about this.
So this is a rare case where early adopters can have their cake and eat it, too, with this credit.
Some of their cake.
Michael in Brooklyn, you're on half their cake. Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi. No, I guess a sixth of their cake. I don't know. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
You're on an iPhone
now.
I'm calling from my iPhone.
Yes.
And it's a fabulous thing. I mean, I think everyone should just run out and be overjoyed that they can now get it for $200 cheaper. I don't really care about the $200. My fiance is a bit pissed, but you know, the way I look at it, the first bill I got from AT&T was $1,700. So,
wow.
You know, the $200 doesn't really mean much.
Right. There's a guy who hacked in recently and was able to change the carrier. So you're not locked into AT&T?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess you have to pay him $500 to sell you one of his specialized.
But $1,700. Wow. I hope that's a very good investment for your business.
It was a mistake, so.
Michael, thanks a lot. Gabriella in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi. I am owning iPhone, and I want to say it means nothing to have it 2 months ago and to pay that much. And for me, from being a very friendly, attractive product of Mac, switching to the really unpleasant environment of the cellular phone. I cannot believe that he has just the nerve to do something so drastic, and we feel very frustrated, at least me. And I don't think that $100 credit can do it.
Are you saying that the iPhone is an unpleasant technical environment?
No, I'm saying that the product now seems more belong to the unfriendly environment of general cellular phone and cellular industry.
Yes.
As opposed to be so attractive and sweet and popular as it was before. I can't even express how disappointed I am with this decision.
Gabriella, thank you very much. You know, Sri, it's funny. I don't own a BlackBerry or an iPhone, but yesterday I had occasion to borrow somebody's BlackBerry to look up something on the web, and I immediately started touching the screen. And the guy said, "What do you think? This is an iPhone?"
Yes, that's one of the new technologies that Apple has implemented, and it's also in all their new line of iPods that they announced this week as well. I also want to point out that, you know, Apple is very conscious of their fan base, and the cult of Mac is here to stay, and this is not going to be detrimental in the long run to the way people deal with Apple.
What's the new iPod that's just out?
No, they have a whole new range of iPods that have almost all the features of the iPhone without the phone itself. So if you like the ability to touch and scroll on the screen itself, have video in a new way, all of those things are now capable. The new iPods can now do those things.
Now, here's Lynn in Manhattan, who's blind and says the iPhone is not a blind-friendly tool. Lynn, do I have that right?
Oh, it is not. It's totally not a blind-friendly tool. And they created this device after the Federal Communications, whatever, came out with Section 255, which, among other things, includes manufacturers in the mandate to start making products accessible.
Is it because you have to see where you are on the screen in order to know what to touch?
There's no feedback loop. There's no. I mean, they possibly could have done a screen thing with, you know, which allowed for speech output, which could have been accessible. There are ways to work with that, but, you know, they're so allergic to buttons, they couldn't include three buttons to also make that possible or whatever.
Wow. Sri, have you thought about that?
Well, this has been written about a little bit, and it, not just blind people, but even sighted folks have, who are used to the tactile feedback that you get from pressing a button, have found it difficult to type with their thumbs.
I have to spend $600 for a telephone. I don't get anything fancier than other people get to spend that money to get speech output on my phone. And when somebody, I think it was the Blind Confidential blog, was addressing the issue of the inaccessibility of the iPhone, we got, there was so much bashing of blind people for, like, wanting to hold back progress. And you should only know what we spend for technology.
No, we should follow up on this and do a separate segment. Lynn, thank you for your call. Justin in Orange was one of the callers, he says, to our original Do You Love Your iPhone call it back on July 6th, Justin?
Hi, Brent.
Did you love your iPhone then?
I loved my iPhone then. I still love it now.
And how do you feel about this whole price point thing?
I'm not upset about it, and I'm a little baffled that everybody's causing such an uproar about it. I mean, this is Apple. Apple puts out new products regularly. And it's the nature of technology. I mean, new things come out, prices change. It's to be expected. And if you got the iPhone when it came out, you should know. It might drop in price soon. But, you know, if you know what you're getting into with an Apple product, basically, and you're willing to pay a premium.
Justin is okay with it. Justin, thanks a lot. Lisa in Brooklyn, you're an iPhone owner, too?
Yes, I am.
And?
And I think the price drop is a good idea. The phone is just like any other phone. They all break very quickly. My iPhone, the glass cracked once. And also, the calculator does not have a percentage, which, you know, some of the other phones have that. It's just, I think it's the hype of having an Apple iPhone that's out there right now.
It doesn't have a percentage, so you have to divide by 100 and multiply by
something? Yeah, I got to do what the formula is of figuring out, you know,
taxes and things of that sort.
Lisa, thanks a lot. Sri Srinivasan, we have a minute left. In the world of constantly changing products and prices, maybe an early adopter tax or somebody else on the site, maybe you're looking at it, called it a fool tax, is just the way things are done. What do you think of Steve Jobs' open letter to everybody laying out the Apple strategy?
Well, the fact that he was, he was actually willing to talk to his audience and his customers in that way was a good sign. And I think that people will move on beyond this. I love the comment and the little poem that Leon has put on from Park Slope on the blog. He says, "I lined up for an iPhone, saying hang the hours and cost, but now arrives the message: it's $200." I lost.
And you can read Leon's poem and everything else that everybody else put up at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Sri Srinivasan is the Dean of Students and a Professor of Journalism at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. You may know him as tech reporter for Channel 4, WNBC-TV as well. Sri, thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. That's our follow-up Friday hour for this week. And our program for this week. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.